Hi, I'm James.
And I'm Anthony.
And this is Words and Numbers.
From Santa Barbara, California.
Yeah, it's really nice here.
Which we're never coming back to.
Because?
Ever. Because these won't allow me to have a cigar outside like a normal person.
No, I think the entire city is smoke-free.
The entire place is smoke-free. They just right up.
James hasn't had a good smoke in a while.
Anyway, what's new and exciting in your world this weekend?
I've run across a couple of really, maybe interesting is the wrong word, disturbing articles about how governments are handling inflation. In this country, I complained about this a couple of months ago, that politicians were pointing everywhere they could except at the actual cause of inflation. So they're saying things like it's corporate greed, or it's the millionaires, or it's the oil companies, or it's the war. But they're always pointing to all of this stuff, when, of course, the real problem is that we printed a tremendous amount of money in no small part to pay for the budget deficits. It's the budget deficits that end up being ultimately at the source of the problem. But I run across a couple of articles this week from different countries. One, Turkey. Turkey's government says that they're going to lower the interest rate in an attempt to fight inflation. Their inflation, by the way, is currently 80%, 80. I went back and read it a couple times, and I was sure at first that the author just got his words mixed up, but he kept repeating the same thing, that they're looking to lower interest rates to fight inflation. And then I just got these chills thinking, oh my God, whoever it is that's in charge over there must have picked up an economics textbook and completely misunderstood what they were reading, because it's the exact opposite. Lowering interest rates is what you do when you want to increase inflation, not cut it. And by the way, while we're talking about that, economists will say, and you would have heard me say in the past, that the reason you get inflation is because your money supply grows faster than the production of goods and services. So the solution is cut back on the money supply. And you'll hear a lot of economists say that the solution is cut back on the money supply. Then you'll hear other economists saying the solution is to raise interest rates. And those two things are actually two sides of the same coin. I'll give you an analogy to think about it. You're going down the highway and you want to go faster. What do? You step on the gas, you step on the accelerator. You watch your speedometer go up to whatever speed you want. What you're doing is you're using the accelerator to alter your speed, but you aren't using it to measure your speed. Nobody like gets out a ruler and says, oh, my accelerator is 2.5 inches from the floor, right? No, you use the speedometer to measure how fast you're going. The accelerator is what moves you faster or slower. So push down the accelerator, speedometer goes up. Let up on the accelerator, speedometer goes down. That's exactly what goes on here. The way to cut inflation is cut back on the money supply. And just like you wouldn't measure the height of your accelerator to the floor, central banks don't measure the size of the money supply as an indicator of whether we're going to get inflation or not. They instead use the interest rate like we use the speedometer. So they'll say, we're going to raise interest rates. What they really mean is cut back on the money supply, watch interest rates go up till they get up to the point that they think that they should be. So long story short, it seems to be the case that somebody in power in Turkey has misread their money and banking 101 text and is proposing to do the exact opposite of what they should be doing. So that's Turkey. Then Spain is going to fight inflation, it announced, by imposing a 1% tax on millionaires. The argument that people will give is, well, look, these millionaires have all this money, and so we tax it and we'll pull it out of the system. So it's like what you economists are saying. We're going to cut the money supply. We're going to take this money out of the hands of millionaires. All right, I suppose that's an argument, provided that the government then took that tax revenue and stuffed it in a bank vault somewhere. But if instead it spends the tax revenue, which we all know governments are going to do, that money comes right back into the system. And you haven't done anything for inflation. All you've done is moved money out of the hands of millionaires who would be spending it, and now put it into the hands of politicians who are also going to be spending it. So we've got two countries here that, like the United States, are pointing to things that have nothing to do with the actual cause of inflation. The actual cause of inflation is governments growing their money supplies faster than their economies.
I've been to both of those countries. Istanbul is my favorite city in the world, and it's going to make a lot of sense for me to go there real soon. Take American dollars.
Exactly.
And essentially paying probably about $13 a night for a pretty nice hotel. I guess financial illiteracy does me some good here.
Well, that's the thing. There's always winners and losers. And it turns out that we are the winners
and
in this
case. And the saddest thing in the world is that the losers are a bunch of people who really can't afford to keep losing.
Yep. And that seems to always be the case somehow.
Yeah, it really does. I am also turning my attention to a foreign country. Landlords shouldn't be allowed to raise rents between tenants, says Toronto's top housing official.
Between tenants?
Yeah, because you already can't raise rent when there's just a tenant in the building, apparently, in Canada. But when they finally leave, you can run the meter up a little bit to catch up to what normal might look like.
But no more.
Except they don't even want you to do that anymore. Why on earth would anybody want to own rental units?
Right.
I mean, you're not making any money. As a rule, you make very little. You get nothing but problem tenants. And then the government tells you that you're in the wrong no matter what you try to do.
It's not like we don't have tons of examples of this. Every time a city imposes rent controls like this, you get almost immediately a housing shortage. Landlords do exactly what you're saying. They say, look, it's not worth it to me to rent this out. So they'll convert to office space or they'll convert it to condos that aren't covered by this. And then people complain about gentrification. But like with what I observed with inflation, politicians get away with this because people don't know any better. And the politicians will say, oh, you're hurting because of high rent or you're hurting because of the housing shortage. It's those greedy landlords.
All you're hearing is politicians blaming other people. And then because we sit here in lovely smoke-free Santa Barbara, my thoughts for the foolishness of the week center on an incident that occurred last night.
And I have to say, I am delighted that I was actually present at the genesis of a foolishness of the week. It was beautiful.
These dopey motherfuckers out here, I swear to God. I had placed a wager on a football game.
Online.
That's right. And I won that bet within minutes of the game starting. And I thought, I know, I'll make another bet because I know how this game is going to go, looking at the score after a few minutes. And I logged on and I went to put my bet in and it wouldn't accept my money. What does it take from a sports betting organization? What does it take for them to say, we don't want your money, James?
Right, yeah.
What is that? Of course they want my money. They want as much of it as I can drag over and dump into their laps. But I was disallowed from placing a bet. Why? Because the state of California had decided that they don't like this behavior. So they said, no, James, you may not place a bet. My account holder said, you know, we would have loved to have taken your money, but the state of California said we're not allowed to.
Yeah.
Now, what business is it of the state of California? Even if I lived here, how is it any of their business what I decide to spend my money? The state of California has casinos everywhere.
So your first bet, the one that you immediately won some money on, you made that while, I assume, while you were in Arizona before you got on the plane.
Yeah, that's right. Before I got to the People's Republic of California.
And then you get here, and as I'm observing it, as best as I understand these things, you would have ended up making a couple $100s on this bet.
I had the game figured out exactly right. I would have made probably somewhere south of $500. No matter what you want to do in this state, there's a bureaucrat standing right around the corner ready to tell you why you can't.
We ultimately didn't do anything about it, but I suggested, and I bet it would work, that if you turned on a VPN, a virtual private network, you can spoof your location, make it look like you're in Arizona when in fact you aren't. And I bet that bet would have gone through.
It might well have, but I didn't want to cause any trouble.
Right.
I didn't want to have to get into that later.
I tell you, that was probably wise. I don't come to California often, but you know, we were driving up here from wherever it was we were to wherever we are now. I was in the carpool lane because there are two of us, so we're in the carpool lane. Going along, and there's a sign there that we pass saying, you know, well, this is carpool lane. There's a penalty if you're only one person in this lane. The penalty was like $350. Good God. And we're just sitting out here on the balcony here at your hotel room in this beautiful city of Santa Barbara that is entirely no smoking zone. And there's a sign on the balcony that says there's a $500 fine for smoking. I'm with you. I don't think I would break any laws here. I can't afford it.
But I got to tell you, it makes me want to drop a lit cigar into the bed and just see what happens.
Well, you get a $500 fine.
Well, that's maybe clear. Not. Maybe if you burn the room down, you don't get anything. All I wanted to do today was gather my cigars under my arm, walk across the street, sit on a bench overlooking the ocean, and smoke.
There'll be none of that.
To get more Ant and James, buy a copy of our excellent book, Cooperation and Coercion. You can find the paper and electronic versions on Amazon and the audio version on Audible. If you'd like to support Words and Numbers, make your way over to patreon.com/wordsandnumbers, where you can contribute to our podcast-making habits. If you'd like to schedule us to come speak at your event, be it corporate or educational, or have James officiate at your wedding, send us an email at wordsandnumberspodcast@gmail.com.
Tell me this, segueing off of the 10th Amendment, we have the 14th Amendment, which says, I'll read it here, no state shall make or enforce any law which shall abridge the privileges or immunities of citizens of the United States, nor shall any state deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, and it goes on and says other things. And here's my question. My understanding is the 14th Amendment has been used in effect to undo the 10th Amendment. That is to take the restrictions that are outlined, I guess now in the Bill of Rights, and say these restrictions apply to the states also.
Yeah, and look, you have to remember when the 14th Amendment came along and the context in which it was passed. What we had was a civil war, a bloody, terrible civil war. In order to make sure that that sort of thing never happened again, we needed the 13th Amendment, which rendered slavery illegal here forever and all time. That's why we have the post-war amendments. And what happens after the 13th Amendment is passed? You can take a look across the South and see our black citizens upending the decision in Dred Scott v. Sanford, which contended that blacks could never be citizens, let alone anything else. That gets upended, but now we've got to deal with civil rights because freed slaves are still being treated terribly, and we can't have that. We just had a civil war to get rid of this nonsense. And when we look up after the war and it's still happening, we pass the 14th Amendment, civil rights. And then a little while later, we pass the 15th Amendment, political rights. And all of a sudden, we federalize quite a lot. And when we start to federalize all the things that we do in these very necessary and very meaningful amendments, the 10th Amendment stops being much of an issue at all, even though it had never really been an issue in the first place. These are nails in the 10th Amendment's coffin. We're never going to use that again. I understand, and that's reasonable. Now, I would prefer if we use the 10th Amendment more. And I think over 100 years after the close of the Civil War, 160 years, we could probably get away with that now. But it would require a Supreme Court to order that so. And maybe you're seeing the first wave of that when you see Roe versus Wade being struck down and the relevant case law being sent back to the states.
Is it fair then to say if we had never had slavery, going back to the 1700s, if slavery had not been in existence, that today we would look a lot more like the founders intended? That is, we fought the Civil War and we had these post-Civil War amendments in an attempt to claw back from the states this apparent authority to allow slavery. And then it had this snowball effect that all of a sudden now you have the federal government clawing back all sorts of other powers from the states.
You're asking a what-if question, and we can literally never be correct when we do counterfactuals. But the forces that gave way to the Civil War would not have existed. And the forces that gave way to the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments in the wake of the Civil War also would not have existed. There could have been any number of other things that came up, but absent slavery, and I mean absent slavery everywhere and always, yeah, I don't see any reason why we would have drifted away from the original intent here.
So one other question as we talk about drifting away from the original intent. People, including you and I, point to the Constitution as these are the rules, this is what the federal government's authorized to do. And yet, there's a higher power, it seems. The higher power is the Supreme Court. What do you do? This is not a hypothetical because we've seen it happen again and again. what happens when you have a Supreme Court that ignores the plain words on the page and says, okay, henceforth, the law of the land is now something else?
Look, it's not like we have to guess what happens. All you have to do is look at how our collective lives have been shaped. What we look at over time is the increase in the role of government. When you look at what the framers gave us, they gave us the negative natural rights regime, which is necessarily a very small government. Remember, the Constitution was fine, and the Bill of Rights, which was written to write down the powers of the state even more, began, Congress shall make no law. It's designed to limit Congress in every way that's listed. And boy, it turns out there's a lot of ways. And yet that's exactly what we forgot. Now we say things like, there ought to be a law.
Yeah.
Every time that gets said, here's what's really happening. A brand new avenue of congressional abuse is going to open up. Congress is going to fill it. Congress is going to regulate it. And then it's going to stay there forever. How do I know this? How many congressional bureaucracies have disappeared over time? And I don't mean morphed into something else. I mean disappeared.
And we're experiencing this as we speak. When Congress passed the Affordable Care Act, included in that Affordable Care Act was language that allowed the Department of Education to make loans to college students for tuition. Now, there's nothing in Article 1, Section 8 that empowers the federal government to do that, and yet they did that. And what's just happened in the past couple of weeks? Now, the federal government is forgiving these loans, something which also is not authorized anywhere in Article 1, Section 8. And not only did this power, once Congress created it for itself, not only does it sit there, but it now starts to expand. Now, we're never going to get rid of this thing. There's too many people who are benefiting from it.
I can remember all kinds of things that were off limits when I was a boy that now we all cheerfully do. Let's just say the national drinking age. It doesn't show up in the Constitution. There's no blood alcohol level that you must have before you drive your car, obviously enough. And yet we have a nationwide standard of 0.08.
Yep.
Now, how did we get that? That certainly is not an enumerated power. We got that in the Reagan administration because that administration decided it was going to hold certain states' highway funds. Again, who will build the roads? And the Reagan administration said, look, you come to an understanding about this 0.08 business or you're not going to get this money. And shockingly, every state in the union was at 0.08 really fast. Where's the constitutional angle here? Because I don't see a constitutional angle with highway funding either. You get issue piled upon issue piled upon issue, and you look right down from the front to the back, and you never actually see that constitutional link.
And here's an important thing that you say often. You're not suggesting that a 0.08 limit is a bad idea. You're simply saying that it's not constitutional.
That's correct.
Being a good idea doesn't make you constitutional and vice versa.
That's right. And many states already had the 0.08. A bunch of others had 1.0. And you take a look around, and you see a certain variety, which I think is always fine. But here it is. How on earth constitutionally do you get a 0.08 level? That's ridiculous. I can't even tell you how you get roads except post roads.
Right, except post roads.
Post roads are specified. All other roads are not, which means they thought about roads and then said post roads.
Yeah.
If you're going to be honest about the Constitution, there is no authority to make any other kind of road. Did they think about that during the convention? They must have, because they gave us post roads. So anything else is an invention.
If we look backwards at the past century, we've lived in a place where the Supreme Court has read into the Constitution whatever it wants to see there to authorize whatever it is it chooses to authorize. And so you have all sorts of federal regulations. You have the Affordable Care Act. You now have the student loan business and on and on. So if we now look forward 100 years, do we end up in a place where the Constitution largely becomes a, how do I want to say this, a mission statement? And the Supreme Court becomes the arbiter of, it already has the final say on what is and is not constitutional. But do we, in effect, do away with the Constitution, replace it with these unelected nine justices?
You see some evidence of this, because what happens every time a justice retires? the whole country loses its mind because they know that whoever gets there is going to be on that court for at least 30 years.
Hmm.
There is a conservative majority on that court right now that's going to last the next 25 years. Clarence Thomas is getting along in the teeth. He says he's going to retire every now and then. All right, we'll put that asterisk on the issue.
But even without him, it's still a majority.
That's right. It's just not the supermajority it is with him. The way justices get to the Supreme Court has been constitutionally specified, and then they decided to make these deliberations public. Of course, people are going to lose their minds when they see the stakes laid bare before them. To get to your actual question, though, I think we're already at the point where you ask in 100 years if we'll be there. I think we've taken leave of the Constitution, and I'll run through a batch of easy cases to drive that point home. I think it's become the case that the Constitution is largely symbolic. We have all that the Supreme Court has done over the years, and you mix that in with all the nonsense that people want right now, and you add to that the talking heads on MSNBC and Fox and all this other stuff. And before you know it, you can't make the case that the Supreme Court is paying any attention to the text of the Constitution. And the chief offender here, Ant, is the Commerce Clause. Congress shall have the power to regulate commerce with foreign nations and among the several states and with the Indian tribes. Massachusetts can't negotiate with Spain. That's a federal issue. And most people say, yeah, that seems right.
And presumably one state can't impose import tariffs on some other state's product.
That is commerce with the several states.
Yeah.
I've always been amused by the word several here, because that would imply, if you're a strict constructionist with language, commerce among the several states would always mean three or more.
Right, that's correct.
If it were two states, it would be between.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, we have never looked at it that way. Those of you who are out there like me, who hang their hat on grammar, sorry about this one. Nonetheless, you can see that Article 1, Section 8, Clause 3, which is the Commerce Clause, is not a hard thing to understand.
And yet it's been expanded far beyond what it says there.
Incomprehensibly. Literally everything the government wants to do is commerce. This comes through best in a case that we've talked about before, but I think we picked up a bunch of new listeners who might not have heard this. That case is Wickard v. Filburn. It was in 1942. Roscoe Filburn was growing wheat to use on his own farm to feed to the animals. And who could blame him? If he had the ability to grow wheat on his farm, why would he want to go pay inflated prices out on the market? Those of us who grow tomatoes in our backyard, why do we do that? Because we want to. And because none of your business, that's why. And so too, Roscoe Filburn. He just wanted to do this thing. Whose business was it besides his own? And here comes the federal government. And they say to Roscoe, you can't do that. Why not? The court said that Congress's power under the Commerce Clause allowed it to regulate activities that had even an indirect effect on interstate commerce. So, if Roscoe grew his own wheat and did not buy wheat on the open market, and this is the reasoning of the court, he wouldn't have to buy wheat on the market, and that would affect the market, so we can use the Commerce Clause to tell Roscoe to buy his wheat on the open market because he's not allowed to grow his wheat on his own farm. You could see where they might be able to make that case if Roscoe's farm existed over a state border into another state. And the argument became, it's going to be about pricing. More people who opt out of buying on the market, the more the price goes down, et cetera, et cetera. This was all under a thing called the Agricultural Adjustment Act.
To drive the point home to our listeners, let me use that same reasoning, and I'm not stretching it, this is the exact reasoning, and apply it to something that will be more familiar to us. It would be as if the federal government found a student who was studying accounting and said, we, the federal government, now tell you, you must go study medicine. The authority we have is that by studying accounting and not medicine, we'll have fewer doctors. That will affect the price of doctors. Therefore, it's going to affect commerce in the medical industry. And via the Commerce Clause, we now have the authority to tell you, the student, you may not study accounting. You have to go study medicine instead.
substitute the cow for the student and the wheat for the medicine and the accounting. And that's exactly the argument the federal government is making here.
I've got such a better example for you. Everybody out there, I'm sure, knows what a gun-free school zone is. We've been using this language for a very long time. Congress passed a federal Gun-Free School Zone Act.
Which under Article 1, Section 8, it should not be able to.
Yeah, I mean, what could you imagine could be anywhere near appropriate constitutional language to justify this?
In fact, let me go one step further. Not only is there no authority under Article 1, Section 8, there's the Second Amendment.
That's right.
That goes a step further and says Congress shall make no law.
Well, that's right. And then there's also the 10th Amendment, which says this is a state issue.
Right.
That's clearly what it's supposed to say. And yet we have the federal government legislating a Gun-Free School Zones Act. And this makes it all the way to the Supreme Court. Now, Wickard v. Filburn was decided in 1942. After that, in case after case after case, the Supreme Court upheld federal tinkering, maybe. Mm-hmm. From 1942 forward, Congress essentially authorized the elected branches to go ahead and legislate away.
Mm-hmm.
Go deal with it. You have the right to assert interstate commerce, and everybody's going to turn a blind eye to it. If you think Roscoe Filburn can't grow wheat on his own farm to feed his own animals, I don't know what to tell you. I mean, that's just stupid beyond all repair. And yet, politically, it was necessary at the time. Fast forward till 1995, every single case between 42 and 95 was settled in favor of government meddling with the Commerce Clause. The government just couldn't lose. And as a result, they got braver and braver, and their logic became more and more tortured until 1995, when this gun-free school zone nonsense hits. Why does Congress think it has the authority to set gun-free school zones? Here's the argument. Children go to school. You can sense Sherlock Holmes' presence at every step. And when children are at school, they need to learn things. And if the environment at the school is anything other than complete and total safety in every way, shape, or form, students will be frightened. Frightened students don't learn as well as unfrightened students. Guns frighten students the most. Gun-free school zone. Seriously, every single step of that was unconstitutional. Every single step. The federal government has absolutely no business meddling in public schools in the first place. Those are state issues at best, and probably county issues almost more than ever. And the Supreme Court, God bless the Supreme Court, for the first time in, over 50 years, said, okay, you know what? No way. That's ridiculous.
Really? But we have gun-free zones, don't we? I mean, we do.
Some places do.
Oh, but they're at the state level.
See how this works?
Okay.
See how this is supposed to work?
Right, yeah. Right.
You stumbled headlong into it, and isn't it odd that you, who are inclined to see that answer, didn't see it?
Yep.
You've been trained by this Supreme Court not to see that.
Right.
We all have. It takes some doing to train one's eye a little further down the road. The court in 2000 struck down the Violence Against Women Act. You can imagine how many people voted against that in the Senate. That's passing by acclamation. You can't vote against the Violence Against Women Act. And even Anthony Kennedy, that swing vote. Anthony Kennedy was in the majority on both the gun rights and the women's violence issue. Anthony Kennedy was a weirdo, and he had all kinds of ridiculous things that he would say. But he tended to line up in decisions where the responsible middle kind of went. He was that swing vote, and you could kind of track how things were by seeing where he jumped. The court reversed its stance with the federal marijuana ban in 2005 with Gonzalez v. Raich and gave Congress the right to criminalize the production of homegrown weed, even when states have approved its use. So we've got the Supreme Court acting in such a way in Gonzalez v. Raich. In 2005, by logic, marijuana should have been sent away from federal control. There should have been no federal statement on marijuana at all in 2005. Instead, the Supreme Court, Kennedy again joining the majority, and even Scalia joining the majority, Thomas saying no. Wickard and its technicalities came into play here too. What role should the government ever play in marijuana? It asserts it plays a role. There's no language in the Constitution which makes that clearly so. We could get into the entire drug industry. What are these scheduled drugs anyway? Schedule 1, 2, 3, 4. It's just ridiculous to think that the federal government has this authority, let alone has it to such a deep degree that it could be categorizing things with different punishments for each.
Even beyond that, that it would establish an FDA to begin with.
Yeah, all of the agencies come into play here. Now, you can see where there might be a Secretary of Commerce in the cabinet, because commerce is specified. And everything else that was specified, maybe the Postmaster General. These sorts of jobs seem perfectly consonant with specified things. But beyond those, we're left looking at a constitution that's been ritualistically abused for well over 100 years. Once that happens, I don't think you can get the genie back in the bottle ever again. I think what's destined to happen here are one of two things. We're going to get this idea that the Constitution itself is just largely symbolic, and we'll treat it the way that the British treat their so-called unwritten Constitution. Everybody in government in Britain knows that they can't really get away with certain things because it's unconstitutional. Okay, sure, but show me where the Constitution is. Oh, yeah, it's unwritten. It stands atop these other documents that are written and give us a pretty good indication. That actually works. I don't like it, but given the host of alternatives that I see right now, that's probably the best one. And I think, on balance, one of the two most likely answers. The other answer is that it will continue to spin out of control. And as it does, its power grabs will become more and more cartoonish over time, to such a day when nothing they say matters anymore. And you see the government just collapse. I think that's going to be tied necessarily to our looming bankruptcy problem, or insolvency problem, as the U.S. government might call it. The deficit, the debt problem that we talk about all the time. I suspect these two things are going to hit at roughly the same moment. Because Congress will be panicking as our financial catastrophe looms ever closer. And the more they panic, the more they'll try to do, the more they'll try to do, the more of it will be ridiculous. And then all the shit hits all the fans at the same exact minute. I think that's much more likely. But I leave open the possibility that the former might actually work.
You often say that people get the government they deserve. I think we deserve the Supreme Court we have because we've come to treat it over the past half century, maybe more, as a super Congress. So when it comes time to nominate a Supreme Court justice, the rest of us are asking, how's this person going to vote on my particular topic? Which shouldn't be the question at all. The question should be, can you read the Constitution? Can you think logically? Can you apply it?
You see certain justices who occupy the ideological far points. And a number of them received nearly unanimous decisions by the Senate. You should, in the Senate, say something like, look, this is presidential prerogative. We did not win the presidency in the last election. Elections have consequences. This is a consequence. Whoever gets named, as long as he or she is competent, you vote in favor. You don't vote against because you don't like what this person might have said about Roe versus Wade in a lecture he gave 30 years ago. That's way out of bounds. Now, there's nothing holding the Senate to that line. They can do whatever they want. All I'm saying is they should want to do something like this. And in their better moments, that's exactly what they do. Go look up some of the counts. You can get a pretty good idea right from Wikipedia who got a free pass and who didn't. You say a super legislature. I guess that's right. But this works against the constitutional regime that we got in 1787.
I'm left at the end of the day wondering, what role does Congress play anymore? You have the House, tax bills originate there, but largely the day-to-day stuff, it's fobbed off onto agencies that write their own rules. When enough people get annoyed at those rules, that gets sent up to the Supreme Court, where what has become a super legislature votes yes or no on these particular things. And Congress is kind of left not doing much of anything, save for setting the tax code. And even that, it doesn't do well.
Installing the bureaucrats at the highest of levels for these sorts of things. Everywhere I look in the federal government, people have, one, abdicated their responsibilities, and two, grown everything far beyond the scope that any of the framers would have thought possible. I often think what would happen if Thomas Jefferson could join me for a day.
Right.
Have him look around at all the things. Any of the framers would be thrilled to see how we live. We live ridiculously good lives by their standards. I think they would also be horrified by how much authority we have ceded to the government. We have ceded a lot of authority to the government, and the Supreme Court stands front and center here. That's all the time we've got this week. Join us next week on Words and Numbers when we'll tackle something, I don't know, different. Until then, you can follow us on Twitter. Handles are in the show notes. You can join us at the Facebook Words and Numbers Backstage group where the conversation continues. Or you can do that stupid thing that Anthony always talks about. And again, I'm clearing out my inbox today of all your foolishness.
You can stop by our nice, shiny new website, wordsandnumbers.org, and you can send us email at wordsandnumberspodcast@gmail.com.
And until we meet again, please be nice to each other. Ant, I'll see you next week.
See you next week, James.